Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Are beef cattle producers beginning to hold back some heifers for breeding or not? Are we still in contraction mode? Friday's USDA Cattle on Feed report offers hardly any clue to that. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham says we will probably have to wait a month for the next real clue.
When we get the October 1st inventory number, it will provide us with a breakout of the sex of the animals on feed. So that could provide us with a little indication about whether or not, you know, we're seeing higher proportions of heifers being put on feed, you know, which could give us a little bit of an indication about the retention of heifers for addition to the breeding herd.
Meanwhile, Friday's Cattle on Feed report shows August placements into feedlots 1% below a year ago and the September 1st feedlot inventory up 1%. Gary Crawford, Washington.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're trying to figure out how you can possibly continue to spend money like this without consequences.
Debate on the floor of the House of Representatives on Wednesday on a continuing resolution. Texas Republican Chip Roy.
I don't know, 14, 16 Republicans opposed the CR plus save. I understand why. I'm sympathetic to some of their arguments. But I don't believe that you can come down here, do that, and then complain about the result of where we now find ourselves, which is now we have before us the continuing resolution into December, which many of us wanted to avoid, and it was the logical outcome of the tactics chosen by a handful of my colleagues. I'm proud of the Republican Conference when we have been united over the last 20 months. We've done some extraordinary things. We have reopened the process with amendments in the appropriations process. We have passed appropriations bills, which we hadn't been doing for a while. We did pass a budget out of the budget committee. I wish we'd brought it to the floor. We did pass H.R. 2, one of the strongest border security measures we've ever passed, vehemently opposed by our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. They hide behind legislation that had no chance of passing out of the Senate. We passed strong National Defense Authorization Acts. We were able to get real reforms, real changes in terms of policies through the National Defense Authorization Act, pulling back on DEI, pulling back on the excessive climate policies of this administration, because we went through that amendment process, both for appropriations and the NDAA. So no, I am proud of the debate being had on this side of the aisle, sometimes with strong disagreement. But we are, in fact, each 1/435th of 1/2 of 1/3 of this federal government. So we have to figure out how to come here and figure out how to work together to get this done.
The ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee from Connecticut, Rosa DeLauro.
We continue to get our paychecks. Maybe if there was a threat of a furlough for members of Congress, the outcome might be different. But there are men and women out there who serve this country whose economic stability is in jeopardy. And we hold that in our hands. So we say yes today, not because it's everything that we wanted, but yes, to continue a process that gets us to fund the goods, the services of the American people. That is what they expect us to do. They expect us to govern.
And the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee from Oklahoma, Tom Cole.
I agree with my friend from Connecticut. I am not for shutting down the government. It is a disservice to the American people. We inconvenience them. We endanger them. Our responsibility, if we can't come to an agreement, is to still keep the country safe, still keep it operating, and frankly, continue to work on and allow the American people to intervene and tell us what they want us to do. So, Mr. Speaker, pretty clear to me, the right thing to do is to join together in a bipartisan sense, and later we hope in a bicameral sense, and pass this bill. Keep the government open and functioning. Let the American people make a decision a few weeks from today and then return. And I agree with my friend Connecticut. I would like to finish our business before the end of the year. I don't know if that's possible, but I agree very much. The next president and the next Congress should not be forced to do the work of this administration and this Congress. They should be able to start. They're going to have plenty of problems. They're going to come here in a dangerous world. President-elect is going to have to create a budget, get their people in place, and rewrite the tax code. Let's not throw a potential government shutdown in front of them as well. That's more than enough to deal with.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I would give credit to USDA. They're kind of giving you their report card here.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz.
Right, they're showing you what the first estimate was for all livestock numbers. When you look at, for example, a cattle inventory report or a cattle on feed report or a hogs and pigs report, and then what the final estimate is after all of those revisions. So, you know, analysts can go back and look at, you know, how accurate these numbers are. Because, again, as we talked about the cattle on feed report, we're really using that as kind of a benchmark of where those numbers are at. I'll give you a highlight here as we look at the latest report here from USDA on this historical track record. And what I like to really do is kind of look at the deviation, so the percent from the final or the deviation from the final. So just looking at kind of where that number is. And, you know, I'll give you the cattle on feed number. And so we're just going to look at January 1 cattle on feed because that's what they have here. But if you look at 2023, they only missed that January 1 cattle on feed number by 38,000 or so cattle, right? So if you look in the grand scheme of things, when you look at the total on cattle on feed, which is over 14 million, you know, missing it by 38,500 is not all that bad, right? So, but I will highlight, if you go back to the last expansionary phase we had, so the early 2010s, we did see some bigger changes from the first estimate to the final estimate. So I would kind of warn us a bit here as we're now kind of, I think, starting to talk about that ramp up of expansion. You know, there is, when we look at these cattle on feed reports, potential for some larger revisions, right? And that makes our jobs as analysts a little bit harder. But I would argue that's what makes us good as analysts too, right? The ability to, you know, understand the implications of those revisions and then utilize them in our models and forecasts going forward.
And on the topic of beef on dairy,
all economists or livestock marketing economists must think alike, because I've seen more articles about beef on dairy this month. I wrote mine not knowing the other ones were going to be written. So I think it was just maybe a topic on a lot of our minds. And where I kind of looked at this beef on dairy, and what got me interested was I was looking at some auction market reports here in Iowa, and I noted that in the summary, in the beginning of the report, they were saying about what percentage of the fed cattle were dairy beef crosses. And I had never seen that before. So I kind of dug into the data a little bit more, and it looked like back to March of this year, they began reporting this beef on dairy crossbred data, and so prices and volumes for that. Now, it's still a very small percentage in Iowa. It's in that 1-4% every week. And so what I did was for this article that I wrote about more data being available for beef on dairy crossbeds was I combined data for South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois to kind of give me a representative. And then you could kind of look at some of those price differences between beef breed steers, beef on dairy crossbred steers, and then dairy steers to look at, you know, what is the difference between those prices? How much closer are these beef on dairy prices to beef steers versus dairy steers? And maybe how those prices have changed over time. More and more as we're seeing, I think, this beef on dairy fill feedlots, right, and be a larger percentage. I think now you're going to likely see more volume potentially being reported through auction. Now, again, it's still a very small volume. I think most of the trade goes direct trade. But the challenge there is when you think about livestock mandatory reporting, there's only two categories. It's beef or dairy. So packers need to choose which bucket there to put the beef on dairy in. And so this auction data, at least now, kind of provides some of those differences, even though it kind of represents a very small share.
Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Budget Act was created 50 years ago this year.
Chairman of the House Budget Committee from Texas, Jody Arrington.
If we gave it a grade on its ability to guide the budget process, right here as we get to another CR, I'm going to take your talking points here, believe it or not. But it's not just the Republican dysfunction, it's Democrat and Republican dysfunction. I think there's only been four times when we've ever done all 12 appropriations bills and a budget in that 50-year span. We don't pass budgets on time. We don't consider budgets. We don't debate them like we should. We don't implement them like we should. We don't offset costs. This is crazy. But my Democrat colleagues actually came up with a great idea in 2010, statutory PAYGO. And it basically said if we spend on mandatory spending above and beyond the baseline, we have to offset it, either side, whether it's tax or it's spending. And do you know that since 2010, we haven't enforced that PAYGO, statutory PAYGO, not 1 year. You know how much money that we have failed to offset? $12 trillion. So this thing is off the chain bad. And we've got to make some changes, and we've got to find agreement where we can to change it. I think we owe it to the American people to do the right thing by the people's government and stewardship of their resources. And we owe it to them to work together when we can to make this process function efficiently, where they are providing this critical information on scoring bills, on looking at a 10-year outlook, projecting economic conditions, also we can do the cost-benefit analysis on the policies that we are proposing to solve the biggest problems facing our great country. This is not a partisan exercise. And I want to say a few things about that, and I appreciate my ranking member. He's leaned in to working with me when he can, and when in good conscience he can. Where we have disagreements, and we do that respectfully, and I appreciate that. But I just say a new day has dawned in the Budget Committee, and we're going to have vehement disagreements, and we're going to have impassioned debate, but we, I think, have been more collegial, and we have done more intentional work to find bipartisan common ground than past budget committees, maybe since the 1974 Budget Act. We've passed 10 process reforms out of 11 on a bipartisan basis. And the first unanimously supported bipartisan budget reform in the House and Senate that the president will soon sign and become law, that's your bill that I support, that's progress right there. We've talked about a bipartisan fiscal commission. Scott Peters is a leader on that. I think I don't want to wait another 50 years to see if we can let this process yield solutions to the $127 trillion additional unfunded liability into the future. And, Mr. Peters, you've said it yourself. If we do nothing, for example, on Social Security, every Social Security beneficiary, every senior is going to take a 20% hit. So what did I do? I said, hey, put it all on the table. Put spending and programmatic reforms and pay-fors on the table, because I think that's how we're going to end up solving that together, because no party is unilaterally going to do it. No party's done it this far. Don't you agree? We need to get back to what Reagan and Tip O'Neill did on that.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Congress spends like drunken sailors without even bothering to pass a budget. There is no budget.
On the floor of the Senate Wednesday, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul.
The Democrats have passed no budget in the Senate, and the Republicans have passed no budget in the House. We're going to spend $6 trillion without anybody even thinking about where the money comes from, how to budget to afford a $6 trillion government. In fact, over the past 20 years, Congress has passed a budget less than half of the time. So today I will attempt to do what both parties have failed to do, and that is pass a budget. They didn't ask me to do this. In fact, they would probably prefer I not introduce a budget because it embarrasses the status quo of both parties. I'm only allowed to introduce this budget because they didn't do their job. And once upon a time, someone wrote privileged rules into the Senate that says if the parties fail to produce a budget, anyone can. So I've leapt at the chance, because I think the American people would like to see us do something responsible, like balancing our budget. The penny plan that I offer today will balance the budget in 5 years. The federal government passed an ignominious landmark this year. Our national debt now stands at $35 trillion and grows with each passing second. To put that in perspective, each taxpayer's share of the debt is about $270,000. The government now spends more on interest to service our federal debt than it spends on our national defense. While we spend about $850 billion on the military, we'll spend about $890 billion on interest. We should heed this fact as a warning. As historian Neil Ferguson points out, any great power that spends more on debt service than on defense will not stay great for long. We must act now if America is to once again be a rising nation. But we're currently on a path towards decline. Right now, we spend nearly $2 trillion more per year than we bring in revenue. This level of spending imposes a tax on every American. This tax is called inflation. When we borrow $2 trillion, somebody's got to buy it. Someone buys the debt. When the Federal Reserve buys the debt, they create currency, create new money out of thin air, which when it begins to circulate, causes your prices to rise. This is the tax of inflation. And Americans have felt the pain of inflation tax significantly over the last 4 years. Every day for the last 4 years, Americans' people's purchasing power has decreased for even the most basic items. Since this administration took office, prices have risen nearly 22%. And feeding and providing for a family has become more expensive. For example, the price of bacon and eggs increased by nearly 30%. If you would like some toast with your breakfast, bread will cost you 11% more. Since the Biden-Harris administration took office, the price of butter is up by 30%. When Biden and Harris took office, a gallon of milk cost on average $3.25. Today, the price has increased by 25%. And cost just under $4. Gas prices have risen 22%. And what kind of answer do you get from the administration? What type of answer do you get from the other side of the aisle? They say greed is causing prices to rise, that the grocery stores are greedy and are raising the prices, and we must have government come in and fix the prices. Even on CNN, the mouthpiece for the Democrat Party, economists appeared to say, my goodness, have they not heard of Venezuela? Have they not seen what price controls do in Venezuela? They lead to shortages and famine. What they did to the Soviet Union, what they did to communist China, and yet that's what they're proposing here because they misinterpret why the prices are going up.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Determining feed or forage intake in a beef cow is simple.
So how much do cows eat? Oklahoma State beef cattle specialist Dave Lallman.
As it turns out, it's quite difficult. And we are uniquely situated and equipped to do that kind of research here at Oklahoma State University. Many years ago, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine published an equation to estimate feed or forage intake in a beef cow. And so that work was done 30 plus years ago, or at least the data used in the equation was published a long time ago. So it turns out that estimating feed intake in beef cows is one of our specialties here at the Range Cow Research Center. And so we just recently published a paper where we have taken many different experiments that we've conducted here and others have conducted other places around the country and pulled those together and tried to determine if the old equation the National Academy of Sciences is using is accurately estimating feed intake in beef cows. What we've learned is that it does a pretty good job. The old equation does a pretty good job when the quality of feed or forage is very low, but as quality, you know, average quality or high quality forage or high quality mixed diet, that old equation was really underestimating feed intake in modern beef cows. What is the difference and why does it matter? Well, I think, you know, the primary usefulness of an accurate estimate of feed intake is to use it to estimate nutrient requirements of a beef cow, say for winter supplementation, making sure they have adequate protein and energy. The other use of an equation like that is for some of the breed associations to use their multi-trait selection indexes. So what is the cost of a cow? What's the cost of a 1,500-pound cow versus a 1,000-pound cow? Well, in order to estimate the difference in cost, you have to have an accurate estimate of feed intake. So what we discovered is that the old equation is basically predicting that on average, an average quality forage, a cow would consume somewhere in the neighborhood of about 26 pounds per day, 26.3 to be exact. And the new equation we developed from this work indicates that those cows are actually consuming on average about 31 pounds of feed or forage per day. Well, forage and average quality forage per day. So that's about a 15% increase in forage intake in modern bee cows compared to what that old National Academy of Sciences Engineering Medicine equation estimated. Having an accurate estimate of feed intake in a modern beef cow is important because, you know, you have to know what an animal is going to consume before you can determine if they're receiving adequate amount of protein and energy. So there's a summary of the recent publication that involves a lot of the work we've done over the last few years. But let me tell you, that's just the tip of the iceberg on details related to things that influence intake in a beef cow. And so if you'd like to dig into that a little bit more, just go to the sunup.okstate.edu.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, we're actually sitting on a pretty decent irrigated crop. We think, and just getting really close to being able to get it out.
Travis Myers is a multi-generational cotton farmer from O'Donnell, Texas, president, Plains Cotton Growers.
You know, and so we're looking forward to that. We're not looking forward to the price, but we think we've got some production out there. Dry land in our area is just all over the board. You know, there's some that's just nearly non-existent. We had 45 days of 100 plus degree weather with no rain, and so we just, well, a lot of it burned up, but we caught some showers in different areas in different parts of this country, and so we do have some dry land that we'll harvest, and you know, that stuff actually will count to make about 400 pounds to the acre, but our bowl size is so small from that heat that we're worried, you know, that we're going to lose some production and then probably lose some quality as well.
When it comes to growing cotton, there are specifications for the quality you're trying to hit.
We can actually grow, you know, really good 55 to 57 cent lone cotton in our area, which is, you know, be a 21, 31, and then a 37 length on their staple and stuff. And you know, the weather that we've had just takes away from that, you know, and when that plant suffers, well, it just doesn't put as much energy into those bowls as it needs to. And so our quality can suffer a good bit, and they just start deducting money off of our price for each, part of that quality that's not good.
Once the cotton bowl opens up, exposing the fiber, that's when you want no moisture, no rain, no snow.
Any kind of moisture after that bowl is open is detrimental, you know, to because the color, what we're after is a really, really good color of white cotton, you know, and that can suffer from any kind of moisture after it's opened up.
The largest cotton growing region in the U.S. is in the Lubbock area.
We do live in cotton country and don't have a lot of options like other areas in the country do. Cotton is what normally works for us, and we're very heavily invested in all the harvest and other equipment that we have to plant cotton with. And so it doesn't do us a lot of good to try to do some other things and have to hire it, harvest it or something. So, that's kind of where we are in this part of the world, and we're just really hoping that we can get some help and get a little bit of help on the weather too and make things better.
Myers is president of Plains Cotton Growers, but he also talks about the importance of stepping up.
Oh, I think it's absolutely crucial, and that's something that we've got to get this younger generation, you know, that I know they're busy raising kids, but unless our voices are heard, you know, well, we're just going to get thrown to the side. You know, we heard that from nearly every person that we talked to in Washington about how glad that they were to hear it actually from us in person, you know, and that's the only way we can do that. And by contributing to these PAC deals that open those doors that get us in to see these senators and congressmen, you know, that's how this, that's just the game that we're in now, and we have to play it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Our legislative work before November has now been officially done. And today the House did the necessary thing. We took the initiative and passed a clean, narrow, three-month CR to prevent the Senate from jamming us with another bloated bill.
Louisiana Representative and Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
While continuing resolutions are never ideal, none of us like them, it's not a way to run a railroad, it allows Congress to continue serving the American people through the election. This is not the House's fault, it's the Senate's fault. They passed not a single appropriations bill, so there was nothing for the two chambers to negotiate in the end, and there was no agreement on the top-line spending number. So we had no choice. But I want to assure everyone, and I've said this multiple times this week, we are not going to return to the Christmas omnibus spending tradition, and that's a commitment I've made to everyone.